Is this touchscreen?
No.
It does not have a webcam.
It does have a webcam. It's down there.
Do I have to bend your neck like that?
You have to bend my neck?
GW Wonkcast, the independent student podcast of the George Washington University's Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. We're going to jump into our episode in just a second, but before we do, we wanted to make an exciting announcement. We'll be debuting a new segment called Above the Fold to complement our Below the Fold segment, which we do every week. But the most exciting part of this new segment is that it's a partnership with WRGW, a radio station here at George Washington University that's run by students. So we're going to chat with their staff live on air about politics and policy in the news, specifically breaking down some of the more political headlines and talking about what they mean for policy. So we're super excited for this partnership. Big thank you to WRGW for partnering with us, and we hope that you'll tune in at www.gwradio.com. Our first live recording is going to take place from 6:30 to 7 p.m. this Friday, so we hope you'll tune in. We have another exciting announcement. You may have noticed that the episode that we released earlier this week was just an interview. We're going to start releasing our Below the Fold and interview segments at different times every week so we can dive a little bit deeper into each of those different segments. So you can expect to hear a Below the Fold episode released every Monday from now on and an interview episode released every Wonky Wednesday. We hope you like this new format, and we'll go ahead and jump right into today's episode, which is going to be a Below the Fold with three of our co-hosts. I'll be moderating this episode. My name is Jessica Blackband. I'm a first-year MPP specializing in environmental policy.
My name is Natalia Abrahams. I am also a first-year MPP student focusing on refugee and immigration resettlement policy.
And hi, I'm Eli Richman. I'm focusing on technology policy.
Awesome. So we're going to jump right into our Below the Fold for this entire episode, which we're super excited about. So Eli, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. So I got a nice piece of cybersecurity minutia for you all.
Minutia.
So to make things easy, think for a second. If you gave your data, your personal data, like your social security number, your date of birth, you know, personally identifiable information to a company, mm-hmm. and then somebody stole that data from a company, would you feel like you were victim to a crime, victim to harm? My guess is you probably would. Like, you know, yeah. someone stole something that belongs to you.
I don't know how I would paraphrase that. I feel like I would be are you asking if I'm angry at the thieves of said information, or am I angry at the company?
Not any directed anger. Do you feel like you have been the victim of harm?
Yes.
You feel like you've been wrong.
Yes, but I also feel like it's kind of par for the course for being on the internet.
Because it's a question that has come up in CareFirst's recent appeal to the Supreme Court. They are trying to get the Supreme Court to take up a case relating to a data breach they had in 2014, where data belonging to 1.1 million customers in the D.C. area was stolen off of their servers.
What is CareFirst?
CareFirst is a health insurer.
Oh.
CareFirst Blue Choice it's a pretty big health insurer, especially here in the DMV area. And so, you know, you give a lot of information to your health insurer.
Sure.
You know, your social security number, date of birth, and your stuff that can really be used to then down the road, like, someone could steal your identity and open up credit cards in your name.
Mm-hmm.
Do any other kinds of nasty stuff to you. You know, that kind of information is very bad in the wrong hands. And so one of these patients sued the company for damages relating to that data breach. So what CareFirst wants to say is that the people whose data was stolen from their servers have not really been the victim of a crime, at least not yet.
Because their data hasn't been used by anyone to
exactly.
Do
so they're arguing that this would be a, so, quote-unquote, no-injury lawsuit.
Okay.
Because the damages to the customer suing are only hypothetical in this case.
Yeah.
Now.
But.
So CareFirst is arguing that if SCOTUS doesn't take up this case, it will enable these so-called no-injury lawsuits where people will just be able to sue if their data was stolen, even if nothing happens to that data down the road.
Right, which happens to, like, probably most major companies.
Yes.
Yeah. It happens at a least lot. Once.
More than we probably know.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, probably, because these companies don't have, they're not legally required to tell the public when they were the victim of a hack or breach.
Also, are they even, like, if you can't bring a no-injury lawsuit against them, is there even really consequences for the data? I guess there is,
That really gets to the heart of the problem.
Yeah.
So, let's say CareFirst got its way. And the Supreme Court threw out this appeals decision, then that basically gives the precedent that you can't sue a company who is a steward of your data unless that data was used for malicious purposes against you. So think about trying to bring that case against the company. This might be a data breach that happened years ago because malicious actors will hack into a server, get some data, and hold it on a server for years before they do anything with it, because they want to evade detection, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have to be able to, first of all, link that any consequences of that data breach were linked to that data breach. So you would have to be able to say, this fallacious credit card was just opened, that's because of this data breach that happened 8 years ago. And then be able to prove that to a court of law.
Mm. And prove that it was that specific company.
That it was that data breach. And that you didn't lose your information in some other way. Mm-hmm. And so that would put a tremendous burden on the consumer, on the patients in this case, to be able to prove how the data was lost. And so this is, I think, kind of an outrageous appeal on CareFirst's case, because they're essentially saying, we lost this person's data. We were not good stewards of this data.
Yeah.
But, we don't think anything bad has come of it, so we don't think that it really matters that we weren't good stewards of the data.
Right.
And that is very much not in the public interest, I think. If the Supreme Court were instead to take, assuming that they take up the case, which it seems like they're not going to, that they're just going to let the appeals decision ride, but it's really the same, setting the precedent.
Yeah, because I feel like if this precedent is set, then therefore other companies can use this to say, we're not responsible. I mean, a lot of companies do bill that in to certain places, like, we're not responsible if anything happens outside of this building. Or, like, if you go rock climbing, we're not responsible for any, but I feel like this would set the precedent that whatever company you're with or you entrust things to, in general, they won't have to have any security measures.
It reduces their incentive to protect people's information.
Yeah, because they know they're not going to get in trouble for it.
For sure. But my other question is, I don't know that much about cybersecurity generally, but if you had a great lawyer and you had, some tech folks who really knew what they were doing, how possible would it actually be for you to, for example, 2 years after your data had been stolen, trace the stealing of that data back to a particular company? Is that something that's really feasible or not? Do you know?
Well, I think it would depend on the legal standard that the court would set if they found that you did have to prove a link.
Okay.
Since right now the no-injury lawsuits are kind of okay by legal standards, at least so far as the appeals decision. But if they were going to set a new legal standard, now my understanding is that usually it would be pretty easy.
Okay.
That the legal standard they would set would be such that if you could prove that the data breach happened and you could prove that your information was on it,
that would probably be enough for a court.
That's enough information to show that, there was enough reasonable cause that it came from that.
Okay, yeah.
But it could go another way. They could lay down a different legal standard. On the other hand, if they kept the appeals court's decision, then that really puts companies on notice. Basically, it's a question of, is Supreme Court more concerned with enabling these no-injury lawsuits in the future, or more concerned with putting into place a regime where companies feel like they are actually personally liable for their customers' data.
Right.
I think that they are personally liable. I think the trouble comes in setting an exact amount of how much is paid in damages, since these are all hypothetical cases, and we can't say, like, if my identity...
Since the damages are hypothetical.
Sorry, the damages are hypothetical. So if the damages are hypothetical, I can't put a dollar amount to, oh, my identity got stolen, so, and it's cost me however many money.
Yeah, that's a good point. I actually don't know what the... I think they haven't set an exact amount of damages yet, because this is an appeals court sending it back to the circuit court.
But no, that's what I'm saying. It's like, how do you... Because I totally agree that, like, they should take responsibility for losing the data. They should have had more securities in place and then own up to that. Or, in essence, say, like, offer something to that customer or to all their customers that got their information stolen. Like, you don't have to pay for 2 years, or you don't...
Yeah.
Like, something along those lines to understand,
damage,
like,
control.
Damage kind of. Control of some type. I think they thought the damage control would kind of stop at them fessing up to saying that they had a breach, but, like, there's another level to
well,
this now.
I think if they thought that would be pretty naive.
But, I mean, I wonder also if setting this precedent could also set precedent for things outside of large companies stealing data, in terms of, like, other, like, crimes? I don't know if that would be the right word for it, that don't necessarily cause injury. I think, like, emotional trauma, people would say. Like, if you sue someone for hitting your car, for example, and, yes, their insurance will pay out to cover the damages of your car, but you can also, I guess, sue for, like, emotional damage, because it kind of may have shocked you, I guess.
Yeah.
I know this is a very weak example, but it could have shocked you to be hit by the car. Can you sue for that now? Because how do you measure that?
I think this is why this is such an interesting case, because it kind of does get down to this, like, philosophical question of, like, at what point can you feel, like, can someone be found guilty for a crime? So that's, like, a whole other
topic,
whole
but
other
yes.
philosophical thing. But, yeah, that's a really interesting point. But, Natalia, you also had something you wanted to talk about that was below the fold that is about precedents and setting them and
their consequences. So this week for my below the fold, I want to talk about a memo. So there was a memo that was kind of taken around between House Republicans and the Trump administration that would reveal what they claim would reveal information saying that the FBI did somewhat of a shady investigation into Donald Trump's campaign manager during the campaign, and that led to the full investigation of the campaign. But they're claiming that it was done, they're claiming that this memo would reveal that it was done in a legal way.
Right.
So this is that Nunes memo that everyone's talking
yes,
about,
this is
right?
the Nunes memo, yes. But this is causing a lot of backlash within the security fields, because it could possibly set a precedent about revealing president secrets, and also revealing secrets in general that have to do with national security. Because if they reveal this information, what's to stop them from revealing other types of information? And they're claiming that if you read this memo out of context, it could give you the wrong message, and that you wouldn't have the full picture and understanding of what actually happened during the FBI investigation into the Trump campaign. However, they can't release the other supporting documents that would clarify what's going on, because that actually would be a breach of security. So the concern now is, can we let them release this memo, even though everybody is like, no, don't do it, but the White House is like, yes, do it. And what type of precedent does that set for release of information?
So the issue is, so you don't need security clearance to see the memo, right? Mm-hmm. But you do need security clearance to see the contextual documents.
Yes.
That's the problem.
Yes.
Okay.
So they're worried about a misinterpretation by the public that would potentially...
Yes. So what the memo would seem to do, I guess, would be more so of, like, a win for the Trump administration in terms of this whole Russia investigation, kind of advocating Trump's idea that, you know, this is all a sham because there was, like, a somewhat illegal investigation done on my campaign and spying and yada, yada, yada. However, people in the security field are like, no, that's not the point. Also, this memo would be released without context so to the other information.
What do you think the context is? Do you think the context is stuff that wouldn't exonerate, like, Trump as much as maybe the White House is hoping that it would? Or is it of a different kind?
No, guys, this is getting really above the fold.
Well, I think it's important because if you're asking, like, in terms of setting a precedent for whether or not information is released in future cases like mm-hmm. this, it's important to look at, like, who has what interests mm-hmm. and why are the different parties, like, pushing for the side of the issue that they're pushing for, right? That's all I was trying to get
at. No, like, but that is super true because whenever you analyze a policy, you do have to look at the politics and the policy of it because that implicates on which way you're going to go because something can be good policy, but it's not good politics, or it can be good politics,
right.
but not good policy.
Exactly.
So, and vice versa. So setting this precedent of release of information, what does that mean? Does that mean, like, presidents can go out releasing anything? Can we request anything? Do we now expect them to release any little thing?
Right.
And so I'm just, like, wondering what type of policy that would set for in terms of, like, kind of freedom of information, especially information that concerns, like, highly classified information in terms of, like, the Russia investigation, because if we're talking about collusion within the U.S., and we're talking about release of information, how much information does the public have to know to be informed, like, as, like, a democratic system, and how would we release that information in an effective and, like, understandable way, a way that shows all sides, and what would the policy be set down? Because that's, like, something else I feel like you would have to write into law that would say, if you look at, like, the Freedom of Information Act,
mm-hmm.
would that be an addendum to the Freedom of Information Act? Would that be something completely separate? Would that only pertain to cases that are high profile? And what constitutes as high profile in terms of cases to release information the public can have?
I just think it's probably one of those things where that decision has already been made following policies that are already in place. Like, the people who've classified this information have decided that it's classified for a good reason, probably following all the protocols that they have that help mm-hmm. them make those kinds of decisions. So I guess in my mind, it's like, I would defer to the folks who are conducting this investigation and have decided for probably a really good reason that this information needs to be classified. But it's kind of weird to me that it's, like, being hinted at that there's context that would, like, contradict whatever message is in the actual mm-hmm. memo, which is, like, kind of giving information away at the same time. I don't know. I feel like those procedures are already in place and this information is classified for a reason.
But it's just, like, the contextual information is classified, not the memo is classified. They're just, like, withholding it. That's like me having, like, a diary and, like, writing secrets in it.
Yeah.
Saying, like, my own personal thoughts are kind of classified, but right. what's in my diary can, like, be read.
Oh, well, that's kind of the point. In my personal opinion, I feel like the White House should be cooperating with the folks who've decided that contextual information is classified and understand that they don't want to mislead the public or stir up rumors that may not be true. So it seems like it would be, I don't know, responsible of them not to release that memo. Because if, indeed, there's no guilt actually there, then the truth will come out eventually.
But what does it say about, like, release of information, like, in the future is, like, also my concern in terms of, like, setting
in terms of standard. Keeping things from the public that otherwise, yeah.
Because, like, how do we, like, where do we draw the line? Mm-hmm. And how many other things are, like, floating out there that are, say, like, memos.
Right.
That aren't classified. And, like, the public doesn't have to we wouldn't know because we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so how many other things are floating out there that, like, aren't classified, but the contextual information is classified?
Yeah.
And then, like, what, as we as a public, what can we demand of our government or our security administrations to release to us?
Right.
And what, like, what do we need to know? And, like, if we release all that information, would it put us more at conflict with one another in creating policy and information? And, like, where does that stop in terms of release of
information? It's just so specific to the individual case.
I just think it's weird that, like, we're talking about the public's right to have information. Mm-hmm. And the president is, like, our stand-in for the public here. It's just weird. You know, it's like the administration is saying that the public has a right to see this stuff that the deep state doesn't want you to see, but the president doesn't need to file a FOIA in order to learn something. Like, they have advisors, they get briefings, and, you know, the president can, you know, his administration can, you know, can see, like, find out the information that they want to find out, even if it's on a matter, you know, that's investigating them. It's a little bit disingenuous to, like, imply that this is a matter of the public's right to see the memo, and, you know, the public's right to, like, see what the FBI is doing, because it sure seems like the administration's interest in making this information public is coming from a different place.
So you're saying, well, yeah, like, they're not trying to set the precedent of, like, freedom of information.
Exactly.
This is, like, more for their own,
oh, absolutely,
glorification.
Which is why that there's politics and policy, mm-hmm, here entangled, and you can't really talk about them separately in this instance.
It's not very easily. No, yeah, because it's difficult, but what I feel like is not realized by releasing this information is, like, you are creating precedent, and we are a country, mm-hmm, that's literally, right, founded on common law,
right,
and the idea that if there's a precedent set before, then we're just going to follow that through until a new precedent is set. And so what's going to end up happening, I feel like, is the precedent's going to be set that we're going to release these memos, and then the next thing you know, it's like, okay, Trump has a meeting with somebody. The person can come out and be like, this meeting was really awful. Trump can be like, no, it's not. And people are going to be like, release the notes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because we've set this precedent that there's a freedom of information, and unless you talked about some big nuclear war deal that's going down, we should be able to see it.
And so we'd just be making policy kind of haphazardly.
Yeah.
Based on whatever's most politically expedient at the time.
At the time. And who's in power within the government? Mm-hmm. Because I feel like, say, the elections are coming up, 2018, and we have our midterms, and say the Democrats do take back the House, and now Trump has set this precedent that we can just release information ad hoc, even if that particular thing is...
But I thought the information was public.
No one's seen the memo.
Though, but it's right not now. Classified.
It's not classified, but no one's seen it. That's okay. The same thing as, like, if I wrote something in my notebook...
Right.
I couldn't record my professor's classes... But I wrote something in my notebook, like a note in my notebook. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, I can release the notebook, but I can't release the recording.
I just have a really hard time believing that this hasn't come up in the past. Like, that something similar to this has never happened.
It may before. Have happened. It just wasn't as publicized, I think, right, in the sphere, in the public sphere.
Eye.
Unless you're, like, super, like, wonky.
You know what I mean?
That's
where the ethical question really comes up, is that now the public is aware of it, and that information does exist, mm-hmm, and they're asking for access, which legally it seems like they should be able to have.
But no one's really asking for access. It's like Trump just wants to put it out there.
So, Natalia, I'm curious, if we go to this place where there's, like, a freer release of information that's not classified, what problems could that cause? For, like, a future administration or for the future of this administration?
I feel like it can cause a lot of issues for future administrations and this administration, because without... Everything is contextualized. So, like, without context, you're not going to fully understand. And I'm not saying, like, everything our government does, everything, like, our security administration does is, like, perfect, but I feel like there's certain types of classified information that you have to keep private, because it does matter for national security, or it does matter for people's lives who are completing missions that we don't know about, because you can put things together. And I feel like depending on what type of information is released, you'll be able to put things together, because listening to interviews of, like, former agents or former CIA or things like that, they're like, we can't say this, but I can tell you, mm-hmm, about when I was, like, in this place doing these things. But I'm saying, like, find stuff out that maybe you don't necessarily need to, or you can make the wrong assumptions, which is what I'm more concerned about. Yeah. Wrong assumptions being made about certain things and people taking action unnecessarily. Yeah. And I think that's what would happen. Yeah. And I feel like we'd become more divided as a country because one person interprets something one way, another interprets it another way. I mean, which we already do with all things, but at least some of those things that we divide on, we have all facts or all context.
Yeah, I'm
so
yeah.
that's my main concern. And I don't think he understands anything, but like I don't think Trump understands that like what you're doing is gonna set a precedent for many moons to come.
Yeah, it kinda is. So my bubble to fold is on a much lighter topic. So bear with me. If you have been in the DC subway at all lately, Metro, you've probably noticed a lot of Panera ads.
True, true.
And they're about eggs, because Panera now has figured out a way to cook over easy eggs really quickly and in, like, a really replicable way. This is policy relevant, I promise. Okay. We're going to get there.
I'm waiting for it.
I like eggs.
Yeah, no, this isn't just a promotion for Panera. Although, they did bring back their lentil quinoa bowl, so they're on my good side right now. But anyway, so Panera has gotten really involved with eggs recently because apparently, the FDA does not have a specific definition of what constitutes an egg, which is pretty rare as far as, like, food products go. In fact, not only is there no legal definition of an egg, the FDA, according to Fortune, says that no regulation shall be promulgated fixing and establishing a reasonable definition and standard of identity for the food commonly known as eggs. So, not only is there a definition, but there isn't supposed to be one, and the director of food policy for Panera says, quote, "We have no idea why the FDA does not have a definition for what constitutes an egg." The FDA does say that an egg does have, like, in order for something to be considered an egg, this feels so ridiculous to talk about, it does have to have been pasteurized, so it doesn't have salmonella. But that's the only requirement for, like, something being an egg. So, why is this important to Panera? It's important to Panera because Panera's got this whole thing of, like, we're real food. Like, you come to Panera and you're eating, like, when you order an egg, you get an egg, dang it, right? Mm-hmm. So their competition, like Burger King and other fast food restaurants that serve, like, I guess what would be competition for Panera? Maybe, like,
Subway,
Chick-fil-A, places like that. These are places where sometimes what they describe as eggs on their menu has a lot of other different ingredients. So Starbucks's, like, egg patty has skim milk, soybean oil, food starch, and, like, a bunch of other ingredients in it. It's not just eggs. Panera wants to be able to be the only, like, company of its kind that can say, we serve you eggs. Like, that's it. Uh-huh. So, they are advocating that the Food and Drug Administration actually puts together, like, a detailed legal definition of what an egg is.
So, the reason this surprises me is because there's a lot of controversy with, like, imitation food products.
Mm-hmm. Imitation crab.
A lot of Midwestern representatives, for example, are very concerned with this thing called the Dairy Pride Act, which is, you know, becomes much more strict with what you can label milk.
Right.
Because they want to protect their dairy producers from all this competition from almond milk and soy milk and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I would think
of beverage now.
Right, exactly. And I always think it's bizarre that on the ingredients it just says soy milk. You know, don't get into what that is.
it's the milk of a soy.
But the point is, like, if there's no specific definition for what an egg is, then can't you just, you know, give you something that's
give
not
a salad and be like, here's your egg.
I mean, yeah, but like,
I mean, that's a particularly
only if it's treated. It has to be pasteurized.
No salmonella example, in my lettuce.
Like,
what you're saying.
You know,
better be a pasteurized.
What
salad
stops example. You from, like, making an imitation egg product that tastes
right.
like an egg?
But
and
don't
calling
we have no, imitation so egg this, like a
no, but this
egg substitute?
This actually came up because the Hampton Creek company makes a product called Just Mayo, but it doesn't contain eggs. So there was this legal argument, like, you can't put mayo in the name if it, like, is vegan, right? Because it doesn't actually have the main ingredient in mayo.
Yeah, especially it's just mayo. It's
yeah, because I've seen those and I've been like, oh, wow, that must be, like, the purest of the pure mayo. Like, no, it's, like, not
vegan. Yeah. No, it's just vegan.
By just, we meant no.
Yeah. Exactly.
No, but, like, I feel like other companies are going to lobby against this because, I mean, obviously.
Oh, sure.
Because they're going to be upset because to compete, they're going to have to, like, start using real eggs. But, like, what concerns me is that nobody was like, hey, let me put a real egg on this bubble.
I'm so fascinated. But, like, here's the thing. If the director of food policy at Panera doesn't know why the FDA doesn't have a legal definition of egg, maybe the FDA doesn't even know. Like, you would think that they would have been able to figure out why this was the case and then bring an argument against it when they're lobbying. But they don't have anything to bring. Like, they're just like, we have no idea why there's no definition.
I think so, they also have to come up, like, what Panera would need to do is come up with a definition.
Yeah, I think they came up with one. Sure.
Yeah, they're like, okay,
they said they want the regulator to define eggs to reflect a food made from a cracked shell egg without addition of additives or further processing. So they want their definition to specifically include, like, just an egg with no additives, which if the FDA, like, I imagine that that's not what a lot of its other definitions of foods look like.
Mm-hmm.
But I could be wrong about that.
But
that
I mean, no additives.
That would shake up the food labeling world.
I feel like it's difficult to say something cracked because, like, you can also have a hard-boiled egg.
But you take the shell off of it, so you do kind of crack it. Anyway, technicalities.
That's
true.
But, like, but that's, but no, but that's what it would come down to, though. But that's what it would come down to. So I feel like that's something difficult to, like, prove and something difficult to say because... Yeah. It's one weird that there's no definition of an egg, because I feel like if I was like, hey, go get that egg, Eli would be like, okay, and, like, come back with an egg. Like, what we all have conceptualized.
Show up with a chair and be like, here's your egg.
And I'd be like, Eli, we gotta talk about your schooling. Like, that's...
Yeah. But this is what's so... Because I'm taking a class called Regulatory Comment Clinic right now, and, like, this is one of the things that we're learning. These things that seem so simple and basic, like, when you try to regulate them... you have to really get super precise. And if you're not going to be precise as someone who's building regulation, you have to understand what, like, that's potentially going to lead to. Mm-hmm. Like, what are all the different ways that someone could interpret this regulation? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it's like computer programming.
Yeah.
If you're not specific enough, someone will find an exploit.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's a good comparison.
Read the fine prints on your egg bottle. Yeah. Like, just, you know? Oh, well, I mean, cartons, that's what they come in. Yes. Coming from someone who eats eggs, like, literally every day. I should know.
All my eggs come in bottles.
But, like, if that's
all right,
also...
I think we should wrap up.
Anyway, thank you, Natalia and Eli, for bringing your Below the Folds this week. And as we noted at the beginning of the episode, we are doing things a little bit differently going forward. We're going to have a Below the Fold episode released every Monday and our interview episode released every Wonky Wednesday. And you can also, of course, listen to our segment this Friday on GW Radio. So we'll have the details to that up on our social media if you want to check it out.
Thank you so much for listening to GW Wonkcast, brought to you by the Trachtenberg School of Public Policy and Public Administration. Your co-hosts today were Natalia Abrahams, Eli Richman, and Jessica Blackband. For more wonkiness, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is @GWWonkcast. And you can send us love letters, or hate mail, by emailing us at wonkcast@gmail.com. And be sure to rate us and subscribe. We're now on Stitcher Radio, Google Play, and iTunes. Today's show was produced by Maggie Gallagher and edited by Eli Richman, with music by Kelly Gunther. Thanks for listening.